She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Our show today was made possible due to the generous support of the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. You can check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com, and we hope you do. Today, we are going to be talking about the switch to local electricity and all that that implies. I'm thrilled to have two in-studio guests for today. John Farrell is the Director of Democratic Energy at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and I'm betting if I did a poll of our listeners in the beginning, they would not really be intimately aware of this organization, but I am now, and then they're going to be, which is why there's Mrs. Green, is an organization dedicated to building community and strengthening economies. The Institute's mission is to provide innovative strategies, working models, and timely information to support environmentally sound and equitable community development. And they get kudos from, you know, small players like Bill Moyers and Naomi Klein. And I told John, I went on his website, and I'm like, I don't know, this guy is really, might be above my pay grade. But I went to a lecture last night at the University of Arizona and heard him speak, and I can't wait to let the questions begin. And joining him is the reason he is here. Ron Proctor is one of the founders of Sustainable Tucson, and you are the reason why John is sitting here next to us. Is that not true, Ron? You worked hard to make sure he'd come out and talk about why Tucson could develop local electricity.
Well, I thank you for suggesting that it was me that did this. Of course, it's actually getting information fed to me through the media, where I saw an article on the city utility partnership in Minneapolis that we will be talking about today that caught my attention because it showed a first in the nation partnership that is working on reducing greenhouse gas emissions at scale. And that's actually 80% by 2050, which is in alignment with what we need to do to tackle the challenges of climate change.
To what I call dramatically to stop the burning. We got to do something to get people's attention.
We do.
So, Ron, thanks. And you know what? It was a lot of effort on your part, and you did organize it. And I want you to just say, okay, Gina, I accept that praise.
Because absolutely.
You
it's
worked
lovely
hard
to
coordinate it, to get John to speak to as many groups as possible, and to really get Tucson to take a look at this. And this will be heard all around the world. So it's a can-do attitude of one person making a difference. And so kudos to you. And John, I have a lot of questions for you, like a real lot of questions. So let's start with some of the easy ones. What is the Institute for Local Self-Reliance?
That's a great question. I'm already feeling nervous about the rest of them.
That's great.
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance is a nonprofit organization. We've been around. We celebrated our 40th anniversary in 2014. And you already gave folks a pretty good overview of our mission, but I would sort of summarize it as, you know, we work in four of the biggest sectors of the economy: retail, waste, energy, and telecommunications. And the focus of our work is really to break the hold of monopoly corporations and put more power and resources back into the local economy. And so that means, you know, looking at diverting from the waste stream and having more recycling and composting. It means supporting local and independent business development. It means localizing energy production, as we're going to talk more about today. And it means finding ways for communities to be able to get affordable access to the internet when their private companies won't provide it to them.
You know, I have occasional whirling dervish brain, but when you were talking last night, one of the things that occurred to me is that relying on local energy as a citizen would make me feel much safer, because there is so much, I don't really live in fear. I live in hope and possibility and change, but it would make me feel safer to know that someone like in Canada, or I don't care where, New York State or anywhere USA, could cut my electricity off, or even the thought of you know, I never talk about terrorists on the radio. I really don't. But I was thinking, you know what? This is a safer way for our country to go. We're not as vulnerable to things happening to us, not to mention all of the positives of strengthening local economies and jobs and less dependence on fossil fuels. So that was my whirling dervish moment. Okay? You good with that?
I am good with that.
Okay, and I like to read quotes from websites when they're really, really good, and I'm going to read this one and ask your opinion on it. It's from your website, and it said, "The United States has always emphasized the individual and de-emphasized the community. From the cradle onwards, we are taught that whatever we becomes as important is as important as me. Whenever the social becomes as important as the individual, we are heading down a slippery slope toward tyranny and misery." Where are we as a country on that slippery slope?
It sort of depends on where you look. I think when you look at, you know, what's happening nationally and the politics that we have at the national level, I'd say we're sliding down that slope pretty quickly. But when you look at all of the incredible things that are happening at the local level in cities and even in states across the country, whether it's the energy partnership that that Ron has brought me here to talk about here in Tucson, that we're doing in Minneapolis, whether it's localizing energy conversations in Boulder or Colorado, Santa Fe, New Mexico, all across the country, I think there's a lot of energy and focus on the we and not the me, and communities realizing that when they work together and pool their resources, that they can be much more prosperous and much happier as a result.
And you can see it so prevalent in the food industry, the growth of local markets, the growth of local organic farms. It makes us less vulnerable since we live in a food desert. Our food is mostly shipped in. So to me, that slippery slope is the brakes are being put on that too. So does the view of localism and regionalism represent a misguided interpretation that we're going to turn back time, or do you see it as going full circle and a way for us to move forward?
You know, I think actually it's very much in keeping with an American tradition. You know, we set up a government that was, you know, a federalist government, which meant we had all these states that were going to be independent and have a lot of autonomy from the federal government because we believed in more local control. And we have, you know, in a crazy fashion, you know, municipalities that have lots of local authority, and we have school boards that have local authority and library boards that have local authority. So we've very much in this country had a focus on bringing political authority closer to the people and giving people more control over it. And so, you know, I think we've gone down a sort of, you know, concentrating trend lately, both in our economy and in our politics. And I think both of those trends are fortunately starting to break apart and giving us really more freedom, frankly, and more control over where our economy and our politics are headed.
And just a little bit of humor. I just wrote a book that came out about, it's Your Mother Called Mother Earth, You Better Call Her Back. And I wrote about locavores in there. And the editor came back to me and said, "You better write a definition for what a locavore is, because I'm not sure it's on the tip of everybody's tongue." But that is what you're talking about. I'm a localist and a locavore, which means I support local economy every chance I get in every way I can. The small businessman, small farmers eating out in restaurants, and I'd love to be supporting local energy. Okay, what about does the Institute challenge the conventional wisdom that bigger is better, that separating the producer from the consumer, the banker from the depositor and the lender, the worker from the owner, is an inevitable outcome of modern economic development? They challenge that wisdom?
We do challenge that wisdom. We are definitely, it's amazing, wherever you found that quote is terrific.
I really do my homework, and I love it when someone recognizes that. I loved that you were going to be on the show.
We do challenge that wisdom. You know, a lot of what our focus is, frankly, is helping people, you know, rethink and re-understand what it really means to be part of a free market. And I think a lot of people have this notion that the free market is sort of this rough and tumble Wild West atmosphere where, you know, people can take whatever they can take, you know, and damn the rules. And I think what we're talking about, especially when we talk about localizing, is retaking some authority over the market and having a rules established so that the market does what we want it to do, which means make our communities more prosperous and make us more prosperous instead of enabling a few giant corporations to concentrate all of the wealth and the power. And so we really do see, frankly, that, you know, that's in alignment with what Americans want to see from their economy. And it's just helping them understand that some of the rules that we've put in place over the past few decades have undermined that, and that it's time to change the rules back and have the economy serving us instead of the other way around.
And, you know, when I was at the lecture last night, I kept thinking about my tagline, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I liken that to when I say to people, you know, make a date with your grocery store. We're kind of robotic in many ways. I come in and I turn the light switch on and I put the temperature up or down. And there isn't a real thought consciousness about where the source is, how it's coming, who's making the money. So hopefully the show will get people excited and ignited about that, thinking about, you know your farmer, know your local utility company, or your, you know, there were a lot of high praises for TEP last night, especially from you, Ron. They're on board. They're really moving rapidly to renewables as rapidly as they can right now. I think they can always do more, but they're really solar rock stars. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say that...
Just put you right on the spot. Ron.
Yeah. With my Sustainable Tucson hat, and why we brought John here was to actually accelerate that rock star status that you're talking about TEP having. Yes, they have definitely turned a huge page in taking coal offline in significant quantities in the next... I think they're dropping their coal. You can help me with this, John, but I think they're something around 26-30% of their coal burning will be taken offline, I think, in the next 5 years. It's a huge step.
That's really good.
But the framework that I work with is about climate change and goals that supersede that rate of coal or greenhouse gas reductions, which call for us to go to a net zero carbon emissions by 2040. And this is just following the science that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report has put before us, that if we want to keep global temperatures to a 2-degree rise centigrade only and give us what may be a safe climate, we need to reduce our carbon emissions to zero or as close as we can get by that 2040 time. So the reductions that Tucson Electric Power, as our largest greenhouse gas emitter in the region, is setting forth in their planning does not match with that rate of decrease.
So they really have to step it up.
In my mind, if we want a habitable climate going forward, and those are hard words to put out in public in a variety of ways, we really need to set this kind of goal. And the opportunities, I think John can speak to the opportunities in heading in that direction about economy and about health in particular are significant. And really, I think what our shared values probably really want to take us towards.
And truly not glossing over the health issue. So let's talk some terms, John. Democratic energy efficiency. What is that in people speak for the masses?
The Democratic Energy Program is really about, and I have to emphasize, it's a small d democratic, is the notion that we not only have more democratic and more control over our energy system and the decisions and the rules of our energy system, but it's also an argument that we more democratically share the economic benefits of that system. That we, ultimately, we're in the transition right now from a fossil fuel-based electricity and fossil fuel-based energy system to a renewable system. And renewable resources are available everywhere. So, the sun shines everywhere, the wind blows everywhere, and these resources are distributed widely across our country. And so, we fundamentally believe that given that we are going from an era of concentrated energy sources, the mines or the gas fields and whatnot, and the large scale power plants to small scale and renewable, that the economic benefits should also be spread widely. And if we're going to do that, we should have more control of how that system is governed.
So you and I know that there is a huge potential for more utilization of renewable energy. Just outline, what are the other sources of renewable energy? There's solar, there's wind, there's natural gas.
Well, I wouldn't count natural gas among the renewable resources.
Right. You're absolutely right. That's another question I'm going to ask you. Where does that fit in your honest mix of things? Because I've
yes.
got my feelings on that. So wind and solar.
There's also geothermal, which right. means using the heat in the earth. In some places, you have very high temperatures, very close to the surface, and you can do kind of traditional power generation. But you can also do it on a very local level, where you simply put basically run a fluid through the ground about 6 feet below the surface. In my home state of Minnesota, that's a pretty constant year-round temperature, about 50 degrees, which allows you to both get warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. I was joking that yesterday, you know, it was zero in Minneapolis. So 50 degrees sounds lovely.
Did we hit 80 yesterday in the Southwest? I think we did.
Yeah. So there's still hydropower. You know, we have the big dams, but there are still some opportunities for very small scale developments. And there are a few other, you know, renewable resources that are just really starting to be tapped. Tidal power in some of the places where the tides are very strong, and some other resources too that we're really just figuring out.
In the world that we can dream about, especially in places in the Southwest where the sun shines about 360 days a year, I mean, almost, I'm not kidding, the sun usually comes out that many days of the year, what percentage of electricity could we potentially get from solar in a city the size of Tucson?
Well, it always gets into that kind of question of like, well, how did you design the grids? Because we know, of course, even if it's 360 days a year, it doesn't shine at night. And so it's not going to provide you round-the-clock power unless you had a lot of energy storage available. But just from a raw potential standpoint, if you just look at rooftops for homes and businesses in the state of Arizona, about half of the electricity that's consumed in the state could be produced off of those rooftops. So that doesn't include anything like covering parking lots, parking garages, or even just putting it out on open ground. So the potential is really as much as we want to do, frankly.
So vast solar arrays, there's such possibility for that here too, because we have a lot of open spaces. Every nick and, nick and cranny is not covered. We have lots of open spaces. When you go out to the TEP solar fields, there's room for a lot more of them.
Absolutely.
In the early days, solar was really an expensive alternative. That has changed drastically. I think that's a good message to put out to people. Why has it gone down dramatically? It keeps going down.
It does keep going down, which is delightful. Solar, the cost of solar is coming down primarily simply because every solar array, whether it's the one that, Tucson Electric Power puts out in a big field outside of town or the one that goes on your rooftop, they're all those solar arrays are made up of the exact same panels. And, each one is about 200 watts or 300 watts of power. And so what that means is that we mass produce them. And mass production is the key to dropping the cost. And so we've been mass producing solar panels at an ever accelerating pace over the past decade, and that the price of them has just continued to fall dramatically. And that's leading to lower and lower costs to put up solar. And it's going to continue.
So that's, to me, really good news. Another thing, and I'm so glad I went to the lecture last night because it gave me some things that I would not have thought to ask because I don't really look at what utility companies are forecasting generally in my life. But in your research, you said that utility companies always have forecasting rates that are going up. Is that a reflection of what's really happening?
It's tough to be a utility person. We just were at a meeting before we came here where there was a utility person in the room and who watched my presentation and said, we're a very conservative entity and, we don't do beta testing and we do kind of what's been done before and maybe a little incremental change. And that's what we're encouraged to do. That's what the rules are for us. And so what we see often is that utilities tend to look at, for example, electricity demand, and they tend to say, even though we've seen it's been pretty flat over the past few years, and that's been true, in fact, across the country, we're used to, over decades and decades and decades, there being growth in electricity use. And so that's what we're going to forecast, because we think that that's probably what's going to happen in the future. But there have been some really fundamental changes in both the rules that we have about the things that we buy that make them more energy efficient. And our economy has always been getting more energy efficient. Every decade throughout the 20th century, it required less energy input to get more economic output. And so eventually, I think we're going to get to a point where that growth forecast no longer makes sense. And that means that we have to be careful, because otherwise we're going to invest a lot of money in infrastructure in our electricity system or in our energy system that we won't need.
And, we're going to have to take a break, which I said the time would fly. Everybody stay here with me because there's a lot more to talk about. Where I'm getting the pleasure of interviewing John Farrell. He's the director of Democratic Energy at the Institute for Self-Reliance, an organization dedicated to building community and strengthening economies. And with me also is Ron Proctor, one of the founders of Sustainable Tucson. And when we come back, John, Would you mind talking a little bit about what you think about natural gas as an alternative energy source? I have very strong feelings about it. And you can say anything you want because we're free and independent. So I'd like to not spend too much time on it. But when people do say that, I think that's not a really good alternative choice for where Mrs. Green sits. Everybody stay here with us. You won't want to miss a word. We'll be right back.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
For almost 40 years, Bookman's Entertainment Exchange has been the place for used books, music, movies, and video games in Arizona. From the latest bestsellers to out-of-print classics, we have you covered with 3 Tucson locations. And now you can buy, sell, and trade musical instruments. Our newly expanded sections are chock-full of top-notch instruments. From beginners to seasoned musicians, we've got something for you. Open 7 days a week, shop, hang out, and enjoy our free Wi-Fi. Bookman's, good for your pocket, good for the planet.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And today we are asking you to think about local electricity. Joining me in studio is John Farrell. John is the director of the Democratic Institute at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, an organization which I believe is the gold standard when it comes to building community and strengthening economies. Their mission is to provide innovative strategies, working models, and timely information to support environmentally sound and equitable community development. How could you not really admire and respect that? I was going to say love it, but it's more about admiration, respect. John is actually widely known as the guru of distributed energy. And joining me also is Ron Proctor, the person responsible for getting John Farrell to be in this seat. He is one of the founders of Sustainable Tucson, which certainly envisions a greater Tucson than we have right now every day. So thanks, Ron, for doing all the groundwork you did to get John here. Okay, John, let's talk about natural gas for a little bit. Yes, it's one of my favorite subjects, and I love to have people on and talk about that. Is that a really good alternative energy source for, like, there's dirty coal and then there's natural gas?
It all comes from the same stuff. The joke is the dead dinosaur bones or whatever. But, I think it's important to understand a couple of things about natural gas. It's talked about as a clean source because when we burn natural gas, the same way we would burn coal to make electricity, when we burn it, there are fewer pollutants that come out. And of course, we want lower pollution. So from that standpoint, that's terrific. But of course, we have to get the natural gas. And, you know, most people are familiar with the term fracking and the kind of activity that has to take place to get it out. And if you even just ignore all of the environmental impacts of fracking, other than the fact that sometimes when we try to extract that gas, we miss a little bit of it and it escapes into the atmosphere. And that natural gas or methane is so much more potent as a greenhouse gas than the carbon dioxide that's emitted when you burn it. The natural gas actually really doesn't provide a lot of advantage over coal when it comes to a climate perspective. And so the way that I look at it is, you know, we have a lot of natural gas plants that are available on the electricity system that we've already built. And they do serve a good purpose as being more flexible than coal or nuclear right. and traditional sources to be able to accommodate more renewable energy. And from that standpoint, I say, great, let's use those as long as we need them until we have alternatives to that. But I think the idea that we would continue to build new infrastructure for natural gas, especially in the electricity system, and especially in a place like Tucson, where your solar power is really cheaper than natural gas, seems ludicrous.
It does seem ludicrous. And then there's, I mean, I had Winona Howder on from Food and Water Watch about a year ago, and I took the rest of the day off because what she had to say about fracking really got to me at a very emotional, heartfelt level about what is done with fracking, what is done to the earth, and the whole issue of storing the water, because it's an intensive use of water, which 2,300 counties in the United States suffered severe droughts in 2013. That was a Gary Napan quote. So you have to, again, it's like integration of thought. Look at the whole picture. So in terms of the man on the street, general knowledge, which is what Mrs. Green's world represents, I think sometimes there's a fear or more of a question about, well, if we switch to solar and we have, you know, a lot of rainy days, plus you factor in the nights, that we're not going to have electricity every minute of every single day. So yay or nay?
I desperately wanted to joke and say, no, we're going to have to go without electricity at night from now on. But it's just not the truth. You know, the beauty of the system that we have is that we already have an electric grid that we built, you know, as much as 100 years ago, and it has a lot of resources that are already on it. And what we're going to be doing when we build more solar is really displacing a lot of stuff that's very dirty and very old and oftentimes expensive. And the thing I always like to remind people is that there's already a lot of variability on the system. The system is built to accommodate a lot of variation in power demand. And so the fact that solar, you know, the sun shines during the day and doesn't at night, is very predictable. And it's actually predictability that matters more to the grid than whether or not something produces around the clock. So for example, you know, there's a great story just came out in the last week about wind power actually helping reduce variability on the electricity system. And that was because wind power projects are actually fairly predictable in terms of their output, because we've been getting better and better at weather forecasting over the years. And so we can actually tell how much power we're going to get from our wind power projects. Whereas with the fossil fuel power plant, when it goes out, it tends to be unexpected. It's something breaks and the power plant goes out of service for, you know, an indeterminate amount of time. And so, and that kind of thing doesn't really happen with wind and solar because they're modular. There's, you know, a wind power project, a wind power plant might be 100 different turbines. They're not going to all break at the same time. Same thing with the big solar array. So what we're finding, I think, is actually in some ways the reverse of what we expected, which is we thought, oh, well, these resources, you know, are unpredictable, and that unpredictability will be a big problem for a system that's not used to it. And ironically, it's the flip side. It's that these resources, in fact, can be very predictable, and that because we have a system that's used to managing variability, I mean, we could flip the lights on and off in the studio here any number of times. It's not going to cause a blackout. That getting more renewables is actually going to be very compatible with having a reliable energy system.
And I will tell you what, John, about 2 weeks ago, a whole grid in our neighborhood went out, the power went out, and you would have thought that we were like under terrorist attack or something. Neighbors were calling each other, do you have power? It was the middle of the day. I was home working, you know, my computer went out and on and on. No tragedy. It wasn't 110 degrees, but the phone calls and people standing out on the street, and do you have, and it was just starting to get dark. And people are really dependent mentally and emotionally on having their electricity. They want the flip of the switch and make it all happen for me. I mean, it's like, so when you talk about messing with our electricity, it does evoke fear in people. Agreed?
It does. And, you know, I think that's what brings home what you said before the break about the fact that people can look at energy like solar energy as a security thing. That, you know, if we have solar panels in our neighborhood and if we have some sort of energy storage, maybe that's an electric vehicle, maybe that's some sort of battery, then when the grid goes down, we might not have to. And so we're actually looking at a time frame where people can individually and collectively find solutions to that kind of problem and assuage that fear without waiting to hope that the utility does it for them.
There were quite a few people in that audience last night that I know are totally powered by solar. Their homes, they converted. So it's really, I mean, that makes you a lot less reliant on the grid because you have your own grid. It's upstairs. Mm-hmm. So it's really fun to see that happen. Let's talk about what's going on in Minneapolis and the city utility partnership. It's big. It's really big. And I loved hearing all about it. So let's start in the beginning. How did it all come about?
You know, it came about just a bunch of kind of nerdy environmental and energy related folks sitting down in a room and talking about the fact that, you know, Minneapolis had a climate goal, a greenhouse gas reduction goal. But about 2/3 of the emissions for the city of Minneapolis come from our natural gas and electric utility. And we felt kind of powerless, frankly. And so we started to think to ourselves, well, what can we do about it? What can we do that's different? And ultimately, you know, not only does the city have a climate goal, but we have goals, and people of the city have an idea that there's an opportunity, an economic opportunity here, that if we're transitioning to renewable energy, if we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, that we should find a way to, you know, boost our city's economy as part of that process. So we were having some conversations and looking at kind of, you know, what did the city have in terms of options? What could it do differently? And other than, you know, beg the utility to do something more or go lobby the legislature, the Public Utilities Commission, which seemed like that would be a pretty uphill struggle, we looked at a couple of different things. One was that the city, like most cities around the country, does have the option to form a municipal utility, which means it could take over the electric and gas system and operate them as a city-run business. But that's often a huge undertaking that takes quite a number of years.
Right.
And the other option was that the city has this franchise contract, which is essentially a way to sort of smooth over all the permitting and whatnot that the utilities have to go through to operate their system, the poles and the wires and the pipelines that run through city property. And that franchise contract was coming due at the end of 2014, at the end of last year. And so from where we were sitting in 2012, we thought, okay, well, maybe this is a chance. Maybe this is an opportunity for the city to negotiate with the utility around some of its energy priorities. And the funny thing is we discovered, in fact, that the state law says essentially, no, you can't do that. And so we were left with this kind of, you know, one big, hairy, audacious option that didn't seem great. And another one that didn't seem like it was going to be legal. And so we thought, okay, well, can we make something up? And that's kind of what we did. I mean, what we said is to the city, we know that municipalization is an option. We know that you're probably not going to want to go through with it. But it's a two-step process. One is doing a referendum on the ballot, and the second part is actually like pulling the trigger and moving ahead with it. We thought, well, what if we just do part one? What if we just put this on the ballot? And even if we don't vote on it, people are going to start talking about this, and we're going to start getting some real interest. And so that's what happened during 2013. It was a municipal election year. City council was up for election. The mayor was up for election. And, you know, we were just a bunch of rabble-rousers out there making energy a part of that campaign and talking a lot about putting something on the ballot for municipalization. And by August of that year, the utilities had both come to us and to the city and said, essentially, we'd like to work with you. We'd rather not have this be confrontational. We're interested in helping the city work on its greenhouse gas goals and to address some of these other concerns. Please don't stick this on the ballot. You know, let's work on this partnership agreement instead, and we'll tie it into this franchise contract. And so what ultimately happened and was approved in October of last year in 2014 was that the city and the utilities have formally signed a partnership agreement. It's a parallel to this franchise document, which we were not able to insert things into. So it's a really novel thing. It's never been tried before. And it had its first meeting a couple weeks ago, and we'll kind of see where we go with it. But we're very excited that we've managed to create a forum in which, you know, now we have local decision-making authority over our energy issues in a way we've never had before.
And in a really partnership way. I mean, it's unbelievable. I love to say hashtag, but I'm an old hippie, and it's hashtag power to the people. Because in so many instances when I'm interviewing guests from all over the country, yourself included, people do have the power, and we just forget that. We just forget that. We forget the individual and what we could do to really bring about unbelievable change when we set our mind to it, getting hormones out of growth hormones out of milk. Mothers did that. They went up against Walmart and places like that. So the power to the people. As the initiative develops, you in your role at the Institute, what are some of the things that you hope come out of it that you can then be used, you know, use them as a model for other communities? Because people will take note. There are lots of us in mainstream America that care a whole heck of a lot about our energy sources and about our air quality. What are some of the things you hope you learn? Because believe me, I know you've thought about it. There's no doubt in my mind, bizarre that you are.
I certainly have. You know, I think that the top line goals for us are really the principles that we adopted when we organized, was that we want a clean, a local, and an equitable energy system, in addition to it being affordable and reliable, which are, of course, the two keywords, the buzzwords that come up every time you talk to a utility. I mean, those are the rules that we established for them, those two words.
And what do you mean when you say equitable?
I mean that we want there to be kind of an equity in decision-making, that we think that people, especially from low-income communities and people of color that have suffered disproportionately, the consequences of our fossil fuel energy system are disproportionately given opportunities to benefit economically from the renewable energy system we're moving toward.
So it's leveling the playing field.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really pretty amazing.
And so those are the principles, I think, that we're moving toward. And that will be part of, you know, this greenhouse gas reduction plan that the city is committed to, but that we want it to be as well this opportunity for local economic development that can really lift up a lot of Minneapolis residents and businesses throughout the efforts. And then, you know, to get into the specifics, what we're really looking at is essentially how do we open the door to individuals acting by themselves or collectively to get into this energy business. And maybe that's not the right phrase, but essentially to make sure that this is as easy as possible for them. So making it easy for when they go shop for a new home to know what the energy consumption is in that home and how is that going to compare to the mortgage payment and versus another house that might have a solar panel on the roof. Making sure that people always have a really easy way to finance energy efficiency or renewable energy. I mean, you know, let's say your house needs about $5,000 in new insulation or, you know, changing light bulbs or replacing the refrigerator or something like that. Well, for a lot of people, that's a lot of money to put up front. And how do we figure out a way to make it super easy for them to pay for that? And one strategy is to put that on the utility bill and allow you pay for it over time on the same bill where you're paying those energy costs that you'll now be reducing by putting in energy efficiency. So strategies like that, you know, taking advantage in Minnesota, we have a community solar law that is really quite good and gives people a lot of opportunities to collectively invest in solar arrays that can be either built in town or outside of town, but reduce energy bills. All of these kind of strategies for us are going to be ways that we are going to enable people to take action themselves to reduce their energy consumption, to have more control over their energy use. And what we really hope happens more than anything is that the utilities will see there is an opportunity in it for them, and not only in terms of public relations, but right, in terms of shifting their course and yet still being profitable, that the city will realize it has a lot more power to do things than it has realized before in energy, whether that's by, you know, changing the rules for, you know, landlords so that when you have renters, that they have more authority over their energy consumption. Maybe it's in changing the rules about how, you know, our homes and our businesses are advertised when they're being sold. Or maybe it's just that the city realizes that it has, you know, resources to borrow money very inexpensively to help people do this, all sorts of things. And that ties in very deeply to the kind of grassroots effort that we've had, you know, starting this campaign, that we are going to be able to make sure that people are being contacted by people they trust.
And if you think about it, if you just for a local community, think about utility costs for schools, just schools, grammar schools and high schools with huge auditoriums, and what it costs in any place in the Southwest to keep those cool in the summer, switching to solar, it becomes a whole different budget item. I mean, there really are solid, rock solid financial incentives to switch to some of these other alternative energy sources that are make good business sense. I call them triple bottom line. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, we're actually doing some research right now on what cities have done on their own public buildings in terms of solar, because in so many places, it's simply a good economic investment. You can just forget about climate and renewables entirely and just say, why are you spending so much on energy when you don't have to?
And why does it really lead to, how can you make the claim that it is really more about creating local jobs? Why does installing solar, and that would be the biggest one to me, because we're even wind, why does it help to create and sustain more local jobs than, say, bringing in natural gas?
Well, I mean, it's exactly as you illustrated, you know, the comparison between solar and wind, for example, that solar is really the best electricity resource that we can generate close to our home or right on the rooftop. Unlike just about any other kind of renewable resource or energy resource. And so, you know, it creates jobs when we install the system, and then it creates this continual trickle of economic benefit in the community. And if you think about it, you know, most of us in this country are served by electric utilities that are investor-owned companies, and they're probably heavily regulated. In other words, we set the rules for how they operate. But the money, the profits that they get go to shareholders who are probably not local for the most part.
Right, right.
And so every kilowatt or megawatt of solar that we install in our community is diverting a little bit more of that money that has been leaving the community and keeping it in the community. And that's resources that can be leveraged into all sorts of different things, whether it's continuing to save more money on energy or whether it's simply, you know, spending in the economy and in local businesses that, again, recirculates and makes our communities more prosperous.
So when it comes to Minneapolis, I'm going to ask this question and we're going to go to a break in a minute. Maybe you can answer it after we come to the break. But can you just like sit back, relax, and let things unfold, or do you have to keep the watchdog in place? Is there any fear of things like maybe falling apart a little bit from the original agreements and the passions being flared up?
Constant vigilance is, I think, the phrase that we have operated under, right. But with both the city and the utilities, to make sure that people keep their eye on the ultimate goals and to make sure that the plans that we come up with stay true to those principles, that we want it to be clean, but we want it to be local and equitable as well.
So there'll have to be watchdogs. No, it's good that you're there. Okay, everybody, stay here with me. We'll have more from John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and Ron Proctor, one of the founders of Sustainable Tucson. We're going to give you more to think about. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday 9 to 5, Saturdays 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I almost missed that we were back on the air because the off-air conversations are so much fun. And someday we're going to tape those, and it'll be probably on some YouTube videos. With me today is John Farrell. John is the director of Democratic Energy at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, an organization dedicated to building community and strengthening economies. He is widely known as the guru of distributed energy. He is best known for his vivid illustrations of the economic and environmental benefits of local ownership of decentralized renewable energy, which I actually know what that means now, and I'm really proud of myself. And with us also is Ron Proctor, one of the leaders in Tucson envisioning a sustainable future. He's one of the founders of Sustainable Tucson. So, Ron, thanks for getting John here and for leading this charge. I think Tucson is ripe for it. You know, maybe it's because I live in the green world mostly, so I just see people all over the place, mainstream people, being very excited about lots of changes and supporting locally owned businesses, farmers, looking at solar. So I think there's a lot of hope, possibility, and change around here. Do you?
Oh, absolutely. Sustainable Tucson has been active for over 7 years now. And so we've seen the change in awareness about environmental issues, including climate change. And there's a race against time to work solutions about climate change. And that awareness, building that awareness, is key to activating citizens to actually make themselves present in a democracy and move this issue forward in the political range where it's going to need to get traction as well to move forward.
And it seems as though, you know, my first show when I was on Clear Channel was Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream, because I was surrounded by people thinking, educated, whether it was formally or not, but aware people that cared about every issue I brought up. So I think that we are ripe for it, and I'm excited about what can go forward once we get the potholes fixed. I'm saying that for some of my friends out there that are there. experiencing extreme pothole angst. We do need to do stuff about that. It's pretty funny, but that's not what this show is about. So we ended up talking about vigilance, keep the pressure on, be watching what's happening in Minnesota so there's no slippery slope.
Right? Absolutely.
Absolutely right. Yeah, that makes perfectly sense. What about water? It's a big issue around the country, and I can't help but think that even in your role as a guru for, you know, Democratic small d energy efficiency, water is 2,300 counties with droughts, severe, not just droughts, severe droughts. Where does water factor into this whole moving to renewables in a broader scope? Does it help us with our utilization of water greatly?
It does. I think one thing most people don't realize is how our traditional sources of electricity generation, coal and natural gas and even nuclear, are enormous water consumers. About 15% of the water that's used in the Tucson area, for example, is used for power generation. So it's just an extraordinary amount. And it's, you know, it's potable water that's used, and water that we could be using in our homes and in businesses, that's used for power production. And then it's, you know, it's dumped when it's done. And it's not that we can't reuse some of that, but we often don't, unfortunately.
And it's all very expensive. It's labor intensive. It's pumping water up hills and down hills and all to move the electricity to that switch I want to go on when I come into my house. I mean, that's the reality.
Yes. And that's the real opportunity with renewables, is that both wind and solar use essentially zero water. And so you have an opportunity to dramatically reduce the water consumption. You have to cut that cost line item out of your electricity system, and then to have resources that have zero fuel cost going forward as well.
So in your role at your job, at your real job, where you work at the Institute as a guru, is it part of your mandate or your mission to go around to communities like Tucson throughout the country and help us move towards a more decentralized renewable energy operation?
You know, it's there are sort of three parts to what I do. Part of it is helping to articulate the vision for what we're about, this notion that we can really enrich local economies by focusing on the energy sector and by focusing on decentralized and locally owned energy production. The second part is helping to envision how we might do that. So in Minneapolis, I happen to be deeply involved with the program that's going on there around the city utility partnership. But really, it's because I'm interested in seeing how that can be a model for other communities. And the third part is really communicating with communities like Tucson, sometimes in person and sometimes virtually over email or phone or whatnot, and consulting with them and helping them understand what are the right questions to be asking. You know, in some ways, I feel like that my role is much less in terms of offering advice and much more in terms of saying, here are the key questions that you need to be asking about the energy system that you have and about the control of that energy system that will help you to understand what it is that you can do to make a difference.
One of the most delightful things that I find about interacting with you is that you do speak English. You speak science, which is really important when you're with colleagues and when you're really trying to get the message across. There's science as a second language in almost every field, very acceptable. Shortcuts, you know, acronyms. I think it's such a high praise to you because you do speak what I call plain English to the masses, which is really where the power is. And that, you know, there was a woman last night that said, you know, why don't you say it like this? Well, it was a scientific community there last night. Half the people there I know are professors or leading experts on energy and on and on. But as soon as you are asked, you can speak it to us that have to understand, and we really care. There are millions of us out there that care. So I wanted to do high praise to you for that.
Thank you.
Now I really want to put you on the spot. It was a big buildup too. You know, my thing is, I believe this, and I'm not a cynic. I swear I'm not a cynic, is if it's not about the money, it's about the money. Some of the foodies I've had on that are fighting, think, you know, companies like General Mills, they're literally getting death threats. They have 9 lawyers coach them if they're going to be on a major affiliate like ABC or NBC. 9 lawyers sit in the room with them telling them what they can or cannot say. Free and independent radio, here we are, Mrs. Greensboro. What about, isn't there big money fighting this? I mean, solar companies will be in favor of it. What about oil companies and gas companies and coal-powered
There's no question that they're going to fight it. And for a very good reason. The system that we've had in place for decades has been very profitable to operate.
And made a lot of people rich.
It's made a lot of people rich. And, you know, the irony here is that, you know, they're operating under the rules that we set out for them decades ago. And I think when we did that, we sort of did it with the understanding that we, the public, were still in control of the rules. And we
public utility.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the, you know, these private for-profit monopoly companies are called public utilities because they are the only utility for the public. And we trust that our regulatory system was set up in a way to control that. But, the, you know, the as you say, it really has to do with the money. And when they see a threat to their, you know, financial well-being, they have put their money into the political realm in order to help change the rules, or I guess in most cases, keep the rules static to protect themselves.
Because they have a lot of money.
Yes, and that unfortunately is the irony. They have a lot of money, but it's actually our money. That's the thing that really galls me. So for, you know, Arizona is a great example that in the election for the recent elections for the Corporation Commission, which is the public body that regulates utilities, there's some evidence to suggest that the utility spending money of the ratepayers in Arizona was being used in that election in order to favor particular candidates who are likely to help protect the money of that utility. And so we have a serious issue with, if not actual corruption, then the perception of corruption, which is in some ways as bad because it undermines our trust and our faith that that those utilities are being operated in the public interest.
I just find that so hard to believe about Arizona. Just tongue in cheek. I mean, seriously, like, my children want me to move out of Arizona. But when I circle back, I mean, TEP is a client of mine, and I really vet my clients. They are people that care about the air they breathe, and they have to answer to their shareholders. I mean, I've had Paul Bonavia on. I've spent a lot of time talking to Dave Hutchins. They have two masters, and I think when the voice of the people master gets louder, it'll make it easier for them to move some things forward. That's why I think the power of the people piece that you bring to this is so important for listeners in any community that's hearing this show to remember. You know, we've got the power, and we just don't need to give it away.
It's important to remember, too, there's this beautiful study that was done, or a survey that was done of utility executives in the past couple of months, and they asked utility executives about things like distributed energy, like solar power. And half of the utility executives said, you know, we see a future in this stuff, like solar, but we don't know how to make a business out of it. And so, you know, what we've got in some ways is rules and inertia in these utility businesses and lovely people who simply don't see a way out. And so we need to give them that way out. We need to come to them and say, we see a way out for you. Here's what it is. It is, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and prioritizing renewable energy and doing it on the homes and rooftops in our community. And if we need to change the rules that make it easier for you to do that, then we're going to stand with you to do that. I think they're looking for that. And so that's the real opportunity.
And there was another interesting point that was made last night that got my head spinning, and I made some notes about. Sometimes we forget, like people will tell me they're so proud of themselves because they recycle their plastic water bottles and they recycle their plastic bags. And I nicely and kindly and sweetly say, well, just remember the first R is reduce. So if you weren't using plastic water bottles, if you could get to that place, that would be really good. How important is it that we look at other things we can do to actually reduce our energy consumption? Houses, the windows we put in, insulation, the first R in terms of reducing it. How important does that factor into this equation of, you know, not being so dependent on the utilities?
I mean, it's hugely important. There are a number of people actually at the lecture last night that raised that themselves. And I can't emphasize enough that, you know, for example, you know, take Minnesota. We have a renewable energy standard, 25% by 2025, very common among a lot of different states. Well, that 25% means a different number if the amount of energy we use is a lot less. That number actually goes down. So maybe it's 1,000 megawatts. I'm just making that up. If we use 1,000 units of energy, but if we shrink that amount of energy that we use by 10%, it actually reduces the amount of renewables that we need to put on the system. So it saves us money. I mean, and it not only saves individuals money, it saves us collectively the money that we need to move to a lower carbon system, to a system that serves us better. So, and I think it's also really important because in the work in Minneapolis, we can tie the two together. The individual efforts that are economically beneficial, like I can save money on my electric bill, with the political activism of, and I can have a say in my community about our energy policies and our energy choices writ large.
I wanted to go talk to that guy last night that he said he reduced his energy bill from $65 to $47. I'm like, dude, could you come over to my house and give me some in-service training here about what you did? And, you know, TEP just put out a call for houses to volunteer for solar installation, and they got swamped. They got 2,000 applications or something like that in the first 2 days. I put mine in, so I'm hoping that I don't know if Mrs. Green will be prejudiced and they won't pick me. But, I mean, people are really eager to see their utility bills go down. It's a big budget item for lots of homes that were not built, you know, with great insulation and have gaps in the door and weatherization and all that stuff. So I think it's another good thing to think about in terms of the homes that are already there. And the USGBC, their standards, it's going to be green homes built. I mean, that's where that would look for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I want to ask this question or not, but I kind of have to. Do you still have a lot of hope for us? I mean, I have had scientists on that off air. I've said, so if we do everything right and meet all of the you know, the treaties and the Kyoto protocols and all that, can we do enough, or is it too much, too little, too late?
I'm not a climate scientist, so I don't know exactly how to put it in that kind of context. You know, I think that we are going to succeed largely at shifting to a low carbon economy because it makes economic sense for us to do so. And that if we can do it, especially if we can do it in a way that communities see the economic benefit, then we're going to stampede in that direction. And I think the challenge for us, frankly, is figuring out, can we do this in a way, you know, you mentioned, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. Can we have this be about money for local economies? And if we can, and if we can be successful in that, then I think we can be wildly successful at meeting our climate goals. Is it going to save all the island people and the city of Miami and all that kind of thing? I don't know. I mean, we might have gone too far down the road already to save everybody from the consequences of our previous actions. And sometimes consequences are good. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and you learn from those things. And it will be a painful lesson. But I think what we can learn from this is that we can make action, and that when we tie together our environmental and our economic aspirations together in a local community, we can do an awful lot.
And that is a great answer. And we pull clips from the shows to put out on Twitter and just have short clips. And I'll make sure that I tell my team, that was perfect answer. It is about hope, and it is about the bottom line, and it's a win-win-win. I love the whole, you know, people, planet, profit. It can all work if we have the hope. And I have grandchildren, so I can't sit around thinking, oh, we're burning, there's nothing we can do about it. It's like, let's go. And the research is changing, the nanotechnology in solar, and we have people like Roger Angel and all of these new technologies that aren't even being utilized to anywhere near the potential. So I'm one of the hopeful ones still. Okay, last question, I think. I'm not sure what the time is because I'm having too much fun. Oh, okay. How can you help us get to where we think about how we use the grid differently? I wrote that question down last night. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You know, I think the thing to keep in mind with the electricity system that is really transformational right now is that we built the system 100 years ago with the idea that all the power flowed in one direction. And I mean that in terms of not only the electrons, but the political power, you know, that the utility had it all. We gave them all of the money and the resources and whatever to build the system and build the power plants and everything that we needed. And what's, I think, so remarkable about where we're going in terms of clean energy is that the technology is not just changing how we produce the power from dirty fossil fuels to, you know, clean things like the sun and the wind, but it's changing where we can do that and who can control it. And it's also reversing the flow of the grid for the first time. That now, instead of everything being essentially like a bunch of one-way streets from power plants to our homes,
right.
It's going in the reverse direction. And that's also reversing, you know, the power dynamic politically speaking. You know, you look in Hawaii, for example, something like 10 to 15% of homes have solar arrays on them. And there's, you know, the urgency is there to do even more. And I mean, Hawaii is such a beautiful story in so many ways. They're an island. They're literally disconnected from all the other folks that are out there. They're going to have to figure out how to make this work on their own. And they're doing that because otherwise it means reliance on oil that is not only a climate disaster, but an economic disaster for them. Incredibly expensive. So I think, you know, we're in a period of fundamental transformation, and it's a huge opportunity for us to seize that. And I think that's what makes me hopeful, is that in these times of great transformation are opportunities to do things in a very different way, and to do so at a pace that we never imagined was possible.
It's exciting times. It sounds so weird to say I love being Mrs. Green, but I love being Mrs. Green because I get to interview smart people like you that have hope for our future and give us ways how to get there. So everybody, all you have to do to find out about John's organization is Google Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Next week, Ashley Turner, the founder of Farm Box Direct, will be talking about how she figured out a way to deliver fresh, organic, pesticides-free produce to your door everywhere around the country. Please plan to join us. Make it a great green week, everybody.